listening. And I want to thank you for joining us. This is the first online webinar in our season. Many of you might not be on the agriculture team. This is the first webinar by the CCL Agriculture Action Team. And we're calling it Agriculture at the Table, Land Use Practices that Extract and Store Carbon. So my name is Jan Storm, and I'm a CCL volunteer. I'm a member of that action team. We are led by the amazing Ellie Sparks, who is also online. And it includes about 165 other CCL volunteers across the country. And for the past couple of years, we've been working to engage the agriculture sector in climate solutions, specifically carbon fee and dividend. I want to quickly get to our first speaker. But first, I wanted to briefly explain the thinking that we had behind putting on this and the additional webinars in this series. So over the past several years, we've been trying to build up relationships with farmers, agribusiness, and other stakeholders, of course, to encourage carbon fee and dividend. But we haven't been making as much progress as we had wished. But in our conversations, we have made some progress in better understanding what we need to do to make further progress. And the first thing we have to do, we know, is we need to take more time to listen to what the farmers and agricultural stakeholders can tell us, basically, about the economics of the ag sector, how they experience climate impacts and climate risk, what drives their decision making, what topics can open or close conversations. And we need to be able to understand that before we can even begin to talk about a price on carbon. The second thing is we need to learn from them. We need to actually listen to the content and understand what they're saying. And what's become clear is that we don't really speak the same language. We have to learn farming language. And so when we listen, that's the purpose of these first six webinars, is to provide for us the sort of content to help us learn a language that so we can better understand what it is that farmers have to tell us. And so with that, I'm going to introduce Connor in just a minute. So he should speak maybe for 20, 25 minutes. Please listen intently, but also if you think of questions while he's speaking, go ahead and put them in the chat at the bottom of your screen. There should be you should see the chat bubble. Go ahead and put your questions in there. And Ellie and I will be looking at those questions, and when Connor's done, we'll be able to sort of, you know, not duplicate questions and try to get the questions answered. I think that's it. Kai, I'm so thrilled to have and it will be recorded, as Todd said. I've heard Connor speak and teach many, many times, and I've been listening to people talk about this topic for years, and I don't know really of anyone who more concisely and clearly sort of illustrates the grand relationships between climate change and both historical and present-day agriculture, as well as talking about the impacts of climate change within ecosystems, as well as human communities generally. So he's not going to talk about his business, but he does use his knowledge base and his continued studies in this area to work with working landowners to help develop and spread climate solutions through what I think he's going to call restorative farming and forestry practices on what we call working lands everywhere. So with that, I invite you to listen to Connor Stegman.
All right. Thank you very much, Jan. I'm just going to turn on the screen sharing here so that we're all doing the same thing together. All right. Is that working? And then, how's that?
Let's see. That's great.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for that kind introduction, Jan. It's a real pleasure to be speaking with you all, and I'm sorry I can't see all your faces in front of us here, you know, through the technology. I've been hearing really great things about what CCL is doing on climate issues all around the country. So it's just a real honor and pleasure to get to share a little bit with y'all. Carbon farming and agricultural climate mitigation is, I would say it's not a complicated topic, but it is a complex topic. And there's even in the basics, there's a lot to say about it. So I am going to do my darndest to keep to this 25 minutes Jan is asking for these slides and comments, but I am going to have to move through a fair amount of information in this first time so that we're all starting from the same foundation of the science behind this. So I'm not going to take questions for the first 25 minutes, and then the second half of the hour, we're going to have as much question and answer as we can handle. So without further ado, I'm going to talk a little bit here about agriculture and climate change as a broad topic, because agriculture is a contributor to climate change, and it's also highly impacted by climate change. So the agricultural sector contributes about 10% of U.S. annual greenhouse gas emissions right now. Globally, it's about 25%, and that's mostly because of deforestation of tropical forests. But in the U.S., most of that is not in the form of carbon emissions. It's in the form of nitrous oxide and methane emissions. Greenhouse gas calculations are made combining multiple different forms of greenhouse gases and converting them into carbon equivalents. So agriculture is also highly vulnerable to climate disruption through increased droughts and heat waves and flooding and other storm impacts like we're seeing in Puerto Rico right now, and the disruption of pollination and the phenology of what happens in what sequence during the season, and also the spread of new pests and diseases to places that didn't have them previously, and a whole lot of other stuff, you know, freaky late frost, early warm spell weather that affects orchards and a lot of other things. So as climate change impacts accumulate and proceed, agriculture is going to be impacted more and more, and that's already visible in many parts of the world. So the other thing to know is that agriculture can become a net carbon sink through transitioning to carbon farming practices, and that's what we're going to be talking about primarily tonight, is what that actually looks like on the ground and how to do that. We're not there yet for providing talking points and legislative priorities. This is really about a grounding in how carbon sequestration on farms works, what it looks like on the ground, and what some of the means for transitioning farms to those practices are. And through the later webinars in the series and some more work we can hopefully do, we'll get towards what CCL can really do and contribute and focus on legislatively. So just a little review of the climate math that I'm sure you all are very familiar with, but just so we're starting from the same point, we're at about 407 parts per million concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. To keep to a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius average global warming, that's 350 parts per million, as that 350.org has popularized. And what that means is that not only do we need to decarbonize down to zero net emissions worldwide, but we also have to take about 130 billion tons of carbon out of the atmosphere and put it somewhere else. And what I'm talking about tonight is not geoengineering solutions that require unproven technologies. It's biosequestration solutions that put carbon in land, that put carbon in ecosystems and farms. Now, it's worth pointing out that we currently are net emitting about 5 billion tons of carbon globally a year. So this is a really big task in front of us probably for the rest of our lives. And if you think we're on a really big scale, you could see that one approach to this situation is emissions reduction, which is what a lot of the national and international work on climate policy has been about. Auto emission regulations and a lot of the Paris Agreement was related to emissions reduction. But even if we go down to net zero, we're still way over that 350 parts per million. So that's where we also need to do really significant carbon sequestration. Even if we do both of those really successfully, we're going to still have to adapt to the disruption in our climate that we're already experiencing. So it's really a three-part project. And I'm going to add a fourth part that's specific to agriculture, which is that we have to intensify food production sufficient to feed everyone without deforesting the tropics any further. Because tropical forests are one of the major carbon sinks in the world, and they're also producing about 25% of the oxygen on the planet. So it's really essential that that we hold steady at the level of tropical forests we've got and re-increase that level. So this is one of the big puzzles in global agriculture right now, is how to intensify food production without further tropical deforestation. And some of that is related to the carbon farming we're talking about here. So, so what is biosequestration? There's three different pathways for carbon sequestration into ecosystems. One of them is the decomposition process. So that's where a living thing turns into a dead thing through the soil food web, through the decomposer community. And so compost is an intensification of that natural decomposition process. The second, and it's worth saying that when dead things decompose, some of that carbon goes into the soil medium and some of it is re-released into the atmosphere as gas. The second pathway involves photosynthesis. So the photosynthesis equation turns water and carbon dioxide in the presence of sunlight and chlorophyll into oxygen, thank goodness, and sugars, thank goodness. And those sugars are where the carbon molecule went. And those sugars, some of them are used to build the plant bodies, build all those tissues and lignins and everything else, but also they're exchanged with soil microorganisms in exchange for water and nutrients. And so the plants inject some of that carbon as exudates into the soil medium. So it goes directly into the soil through photosynthesis. And then it also goes into the what's called above ground carbon, you know, perennial plant tissues, especially woody plants, especially trees, especially the larger, longer lived trees. And it also goes into the woody roots underground, and it also goes into long-lived herbaceous perennials like bunch grasses and things like that. So you've got decomposition and photosynthesis store carbon, and they store it in the soil, and they store it in perennial plants. So in a two-minute version, that's what the carbon farming project is. It's about increasing and intensifying these processes on farms so that we're storing more carbon in land while still producing food. So in a really simple way, it's about more organic topsoil and more trees, and more trees and perennials on farms. So the math behind the carbon farming that we're talking about here, just to give you an image of what this looks like, a 1% increase in topsoil organic matter stores around 10 tons of carbon below ground per acre. Now, in terms of the above ground carbon, converting treeless farmland to agroforestry, which we'll define and talk about a little later, can store between 50 and 150 tons of carbon per acre in most parts of the U.S. In the very dry climates, it's a bit lower than that. So that's kind of the range of possible sequestration that we're looking at. Now, you can imagine that You can imagine that it's this in most regions, in non-arid regions, it's the strategies that include both below ground and above ground carbon storage that have the greatest sequestration potential. And some places are too dry to grow trees, so that's not viable there. Or there's other water management or other agronomic reasons why trees aren't appropriate. So now there are 2.3 billion acres of land in the United States, and just under 900 million of them are farmland. Of that, about 400 million acres are pasture and range land. About another, just under 400 million acres are annual cropland that are tilled each year. And then there's about 80 million acres that are covered in trees. And most of that is forest land that's on farm properties, and there's a small amount of orchards. So there's a lot of farmland to work with that has the potential to use carbon farming practices. And as I'm gonna talk about a little later, there are significant co-benefits of carbon farming practices that have substantial value for farms in their farm viability and their climate resilience and their profitability, totally independently of their sequestration benefits. So those are often the reason why carbon farming practices are adopted, are for the co-benefits. But from a policy point of view, we want to incentivize the co-benefits, but also incentivize the carbon sequestration. So it's worth being clear about both of those things. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this chart, but when you have the recording, you'll be able to pause it and go back to this and read it. But the key thing here to point out is that there are four columns on the top here. And these four columns all point out something important. So the first one is there's lots of different carbon farming systems that add organic topsoil and add perennial plants to farms. And we're going to talk about some of those in a few short minutes. There's lots of different systems, and they have very different sequestration rates and total potential per acre. However, they're also quite different in terms of their readiness and adoptability, and also in terms of the acreage on which they can be applied. So the improved annual practices and the improved grazing practices, which don't include any above ground carbon component, they're all soil carbon. Those practices generally store a very small amount of carbon per acre, and particularly a small amount per acre per year, but they can be adopted on very large acreages. Millions and millions and millions of acres are ready for adoption of improved annuals and improved grazing right now. Some of the highest carbon storage processes are silvopasture and multi-strata tree farming systems, and then certain perennial industrial crops like bamboo production systems. Those have very high potential sequestration rates, but they're often more limited in how widely they can be applied. And so part of the sweet spot here is what can be done on a lot of acreage that's very carbon storing. And so silvopasture, the adding of trees to pasture and grazing land, is one of those strategies. And it's actually number 9 on Project Drawdown's list of top 50 climate mitigation strategies because of how widely it can be applied and how carbon storing it is. And then just a few examples here of what some of these different systems actually are and look like on the ground. And you can go back to that with the recording, but we're going to move on for now. Okay, so then again, to give an image of the total sequestration potential. So the bottom axis here is potential tons stored per hectare. So you have to divide by 2 approximately to get the storage per acre. And then the practices on the left, and then the general type of practices on the right. So again, this is just to show the range of total sequestration potential that exists. I will say that there are some individual farmers and some individual research studies that have shown significantly higher potential storage through improved grazing practices alone. And those studies have generally not been widely replicated on many different types of pieces of land. And sometimes they're using outlier data to signify here's what's possible everywhere. So until that's replicated across a lot more studies, I'm not sure we can confidently say that's possible everywhere, but there are individual cases where some of these systems can store more carbon than what's shown here. Okay, so we have to mention risks and challenges because these are not silver bullet systems and solutions. And that's really important to understand. Okay, so what we're talking about here, most of these carbon farming practices are capital improvements for farm businesses. They are land improvements. They are investments in land quality. And because of that, and also they often represent changing farming practices, which means changing business practices. So all of that has costs and risks for farmers, and especially with the systems that involve new practices or incorporate perennials and trees, it can take years before farmers break even on that investment. So because of that, it's not realistic to ask and expect farmers to shoulder the cost of these land improvements and these capital expenditures by themselves, given that this is a public priority. So both public sector and philanthropy and private sector through supply chains need to make money available to farmers for that land use transition. That's really clear from all the work that's been done internationally and in the US. It has to be in partnership across sectors, not just expecting it to come from the farmer's side. And part of that is because of the economic crisis that agriculture is in globally and in the US, which is bigger than what we can talk about right now, but is very real, as I'm sure many of you know. The other thing is that if farmers don't have long-term access and security to their land, they don't have an economic incentive to invest in long-term crops like tree crops or to invest in long-term land improvements and capital expenditures. So land access, land tenure, land reform are a really big part of spreading carbon farming and doing more carbon sequestration in ecosystems. Is the longevity of those systems has to be set up legally. Because people who are land insecure just can't justify doing some of these things. And again, these are not silver bullet solutions, and you will occasionally hear some of them talked about as that, as in this one practice will save the world from global warming, this one practice will reverse climate change. That's not supported by the data and the available research. But it's a large basket of systems that are appropriate for different places and different circumstances. And that's part of the interesting work of it, is figuring out what's going to make sense in North Dakota, what's going to make sense in Virginia, what's going to make sense in California, and in the different climates and soils and business contexts of farms in those places. So we have to know a lot and learn a lot in order to engage with this. And there's a lot of momentum happening right now behind this. particularly because of some of these co-benefits. So some of the significant co-benefits to farmers from these practices include more resilience to climate change. So, and part of that is related to diversification. So there's a study of hurricane impacts on Caribbean islands. And one of the things it found was that diversified farms lost, the diversified farms retained 2 to 4 times the crop yield than non-diversified farms in the wake of major storms. So non-diversified farms were losing sometimes 80 to 90% of their crop yield from major storms, and diversified farms are losing like 50%. So there's a real resilience element just to having a diversified production, and there's also resilience elements to having more trees and more topsoil on your farm. Because when you have more organic topsoil, your water retention capacity in your soil increases significantly also. So all of these practices in most climates are soil and water conservation practices also. And that's significant because many of them are already fundable through existing funding streams out of USDA and out of the Natural Resources Conservation Service, in particular NRCS, through their EQIP program and certain other funding streams. So we talked about diversified production. All of that can add up to greater profitability for farms, especially on the long term. Often there can be a dip in profitability in the first few years when there's an capital investment being made or when new practices are being adopted. But in the long term, these practices generally make farms more profitable and more resilient. So there's a lot of arguments and there's a lot of interest from conventional farming and agribusiness because of that. And you're seeing a shift in people wanting to do more no-till and crop rotation and cover crops and things like that, even on large conventional farms. Okay, so now we're going to spend, I'm just going to peek at the time here. Okay, great. We're going to spend the last few minutes of the presentation portion here touring some of these systems so that you can imagine what this looks like on the ground and see some of what, start to build an idea of what some of the policy directions are to support and incentivize these things. So we're going to start with the improved annual and improved grazing systems. So these are the systems that don't involve trees. These are the non-tree-based carbon farming systems to start with. So this set of practices has had different names. Some people are calling it conservation agriculture. Some people are calling it regenerative organic agriculture. But really, this is just about the best ecological practices for growing annual crops that have been developed over the years. Some of the principles here involve minimizing tillage, because tillage is a significant contributor to greenhouse gas emissions from soils, because of the gasification of the carbon stored in that soil medium when the soil is turned over through tillage. It also involves extensive use of cover cropping, because that continuous vegetative cover not only reduces soil erosion and reduces soil loss during storms, but it also causes there to be continual photosynthesis during the growing season, and that means carbon is being stored through that exudate pathway we talked about. And it also involves extensive use of compost and manure, both as a fertilizer and as an inoculant of microbial activity for the soil food web. And it also involves minimal to no use of biocides, use of herbicides, pesticides, and use of synthetic fertilizer, because in particular, the synthetic fertilizer use is the primary source of nitrous oxide emissions from the U.S. agricultural sector. And nitrous oxide accounts for almost half of all agricultural greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. So in addition to that, synthetic nitrogen-based fertilizer generally causes a large reduction in soil microbial activity. It kills the soil food web. So minimizing those practices, those chemically based practices, maximizing the use of cover cropping and compost, and also doing a lot of crop rotation and doing fallow strips and herbaceous buffer strips like grass strips are all just conservation practices that have been developed for how to do annual farming without losing topsoil. And there's a lot more we could say about this, but there's tons of farmers all around the world and all around the US who are already doing this. There's a lot of great technical knowledge about how to do this. And there's a lot of great resources for that. So this is your carbon farming practices. They sequester a small amount per acre per year, but they can be applied on a very wide acreage. So it's very interesting and significant to figure out how to incentivize these things, especially cover cropping around the US. Okay, so the next one is management-intensive grazing. This is the core of the improved grazing practice in carbon farming. And really, this is about having So this is not a feedlot system. This is not a concentrated confinement system, but it is a intensive system in the sense that there's high animal density on pasture with frequent rotations and long recovery periods for the pasture. And in that way, it mimics the movement of large herd animals through grasslands historically. And it's also, it's a highly managed system. It's very knowledge intensive and very observation intensive. It's worth pointing out that ruminants and especially cows are a significant source of methane emissions. And so methane from ruminants accounts for about 1/3 of US agricultural greenhouse gas emissions. There is the carbon stored through the rotational grazing, because that rotational grazing is building significant carbon in the soil medium, and that's partially offset by the methane emissions from those animals. So that needs to be thought about. The other thing to think about here is that when beef is produced in the global tropics, it's generally produced through tropical deforestation. So there's value to having animal food production in the US rather than in Brazil. And also there's probably value to people in the wealthy global north eating less meat and more of their meat coming from grass-fed sources. They're using these grazing practices. So there's a lot of things to discuss there. This is one of the big topics that there's a lot of research on and controversies, and you know, people have different perspectives on what the best way to apply this is in different places and different farm situations. But the basics of it are this intensive rotational grazing practice that is well established and does store carbon in the soil successfully. Okay, there's also some improved soil practices in development that I just want to name so you've heard about them. So one of them is the compost on rangelands practice. This is being done in California, and there's funding for it at the state level there. And this is applying a thin layer of compost across large areas of land. It's very expensive, but it has been successful at essentially re-inoculating the soil food web, the microbial community in those rangelands that have been overgrazed historically. And then the rate of carbon sequestration increases for years after that application. So it's an interesting land restoration practice. Pasture cropping is a system that can work in warm climates where grains are drill seeded into pastures. And then there's a grain crop and a grazing rotation in a single year. And there's more complex versions of that that can still be done in cold climates across multiple years. And integrating animals into cover crops, grazing on cover crops, grazing on grain crops after or before the harvest. There's a lot of things that can be done to integrate animals and annuals. Biochar is producing charcoal from agricultural wastes as a soil amendment, which has been successful at improving yields in many farming systems around the world. All kinds of research questions and controversies around that one also, but it is a carbon farming practice because the amendment charcoal is pure carbon that's being added to the soil. And then perennial grains are an in-development, in-research process of turning wheat and rye and barley and all these grains that we depend on that are annual plants back into perennial plants like many of their ancestors. And so you can see the difference in root mass between the annual one on the left and the perennial one on the right there. So this one is starting to come out in the Kernza wheat that some people have been trying and hearing about. It's still years away from widespread adoption, but really interesting work is being done. So these now are, and I should say there's more carbon farming systems than just the ones we've shown, but these are some of the ones that have the greatest application and potential for the US and what we've seen so far. So these are some of the tree-based systems that are important to talk about. So this is agroforestry. This is the integration of trees into farming practices. Multi-layer production systems, and many of the agroforestry practices have some of the highest carbon sequestration potential because they're storing both below ground carbon in soil and above ground carbon in tree mass. So one of the very simple ones that USDA has been supporting for years is windbreaks and shelter belts. So these have obvious co-benefits for the crop production and for animal welfare. And they make a lot of sense in a lot of places. They also are a carbon storage practice. And there's ways to make those windbreaks multifunctional to produce timber and biomass crops out of them and do a lot of other things. Riparian buffers are another form of shelter belt. So these are really, really important for climate resilience. We could do a whole thing just on riparian buffers. But essentially, they are both buffering a waterway from agricultural runoff, such as chemicals and nitrogen and excess phosphorus from animal manure, and they're also buffering the farm from flooding from the waterway. So there's very measurable differences between how the impacts of floods on farmland, depending on how much of a riparian and wetland buffer they have between the river and the farm fields. So the expansion and restoration and widening of riparian buffers is a big project, both for carbon farming and for climate resilience. Okay, so coppice biomass is another tree-based carbon farming practice. This is the production of woody biomass, usually for energy and sometimes for other things, building materials. It generally only works if you're within 50 miles of a biomass power plant. Otherwise, the transportation is too expensive and you're losing the carbon you're saving. But basically, this is about producing energy from trees that are regrowing rather than from fossil fuels. So it's not a net carbon benefit, but it is a significantly less of a net carbon impact than fossil fuel burning is. Again, a lot of research being done on how to do this best way, a lot of controversies and different perspectives on it, but when it's done well, it is a net carbon farming practice compared to fossil sources of energy. So it is worth describing, and it's also one that a lot of farms are doing, and it is a source of perennializing annual land, which is one of the big priorities for reducing erosion and soil loss and also for storing more carbon on farmland. So alley cropping is essentially a tighter in version of a windbreak where the alleys are often crops themselves. So these are alleys of tree crops in between alleys of annual crops. And the alleys of trees are often nut crops such as walnuts or chestnuts or hazels. They're often timber crops such as growing, again, walnut for veneer timber or black locust for fence posts. There's a lot of different versions of these systems all over the US. They're starting to get more adoption, but they haven't been widely adopted in most parts of the country yet, but they're used extensively in the global tropics. There's a lot of experience from around the world about how to do this, including tons from China and South and North Korea. So this is one that there's a lot of potential for increasing its use, and a lot of it depends on making the tree component profitable for the farm. But I should just say that these tree annual alley cropping systems are one of the simplest ways to add above ground carbon to annual farms. Silvopasture is a really big carbon farming topic, and that's about the addition of trees to pastures. So sometimes they're in a savanna type arrangement, as you can see in this photo. This is a silvopasture from Mexico that's using alder trees from North America, from the Pacific Northwest. And these are some of the most carbon storing farm systems in the world because of all that above ground carbon and all that below ground carbon. They can also be planted in shelter belts and alleys, such as those photos we just saw, with grazing strips in between. There's a lot of people doing that really successfully. So this is one of the big areas for incentivization and supporting farmers to transition to more trees in their grazing land. Again, a lot of details to this, but this is what the practice is at its essence. It needs to be combined with rotational grazing, because otherwise the animals accumulate impact on the root systems of the trees and the trees die. So you have to be moving the animals to make this work successfully. Okay, so these are some of the more experimental systems out there, but they're also some of the most carbon storing. These are multi-strata agroforestry systems. They're done extensively in the tropics. They have a multi-tens of thousands of year history all around the world, in the global south especially. And they're some of the most sustainable and biodiverse and carbon storing forms of farming on the planet. If you get shade-grown coffee or shade-grown cacao from an excellent source, this is likely what they're doing on the ground, is they're growing the coffee underneath a rainforest canopy or underneath a tree crop canopy that's growing macadamias or a whole host of other crops and products, rubber trees. So these are adoptable today in Hawaii and Puerto Rico and parts of South Florida. And then we're experimenting on how to do this in cold climates beyond that. And some good things have been learned, and there's a lot more work to do. But I wanted you to know about it because it's one of the really big systems for the global south and for tropics. And these are the systems that can sometimes sequester upwards of 150 tons of carbon per acre, just above ground, and there's soil storage as well. Okay, so I have two resources that I hope you're all maybe already familiar with, but if not, these are really, really helpful. Information sources and sources of policy perspective and for priorities about this topic. One of them is the Carbon Farming Solution that was published a year ago. It's the best resource that's been written so far about the global field of carbon farming and what it means for both tropical and temperate climates. And then the Drawdown Project, put out by Paul Hawken and a huge team of researchers, quantifies a lot of the different practices we just talked about in terms of their sequestration potential and their economic costs and benefits. And a lot of that data is in the Carbon Farming Solution as well. Now, something I was telling a few people about before a lot of you joined, there's a really significant paper coming out soon that I just want to have on CCL's radar. If you're interested, which is called Legal Pathways to Carbon Neutral Agriculture. This is in pre-publication right now. There's going to be an abridged version coming out in the Environmental Law Reporter Journal in December. The full paper is a chapter in the upcoming book, Legal Pathways to Deep Decarbonization in the United States, which will be published in spring 2018. I have been shown a pre-publication version of this paper. It is extraordinary. It's very impressive. It goes into deep policy detail about how to support and incentivize the carbon sequestering practices we just talked about in the U.S. using the existing U.S. agricultural policy setup. So this is going to be really, really useful for everything we're all working on when it comes out. And that overall book is really exciting and important also. So I just wanted you to have it on the radar and watch out for this in the Environmental Law Reporter in December. It goes into a lot of detail about programs in the farm bill, about crop insurance, about subsidies, and even about things like trade policy and how they relate to incentivizing carbon storage on farms.